Hurricane Irma churned through Florida 1 year ago today. 12 months later, Jacksonville still has not recovered. We'll take a closer look just ahead. Good Monday morning, and thanks for joining us. Hope you had a nice weekend. We're live from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect on 89.9. I'm Melissa Ross, and we're always live at 9 with this show. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead this Monday, the aftermath of Hurricane Irma 1 year later. Have you recovered? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, how you can be part of this weekend's First Coast Heart Walk. Plus, Culpepper on the jubilation as the Jaguars beat the Giants on the road. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, Hurricane Florence is barreling through the Atlantic toward the East Coast at this hour. The storm is expected to make landfall in the Carolinas with water up to 15 feet high and rainfall inland over the next 4 to 5 days that could reach 20 inches in some spots. Of course, last year's hurricane season is still very fresh in the minds of most of us Floridians. Much of the state still has yet to recover from the devastation of Hurricane Irma. Can you believe that it was 1 year ago today that Irma ravaged Florida, and then in the early morning hours of September 11th came up to our corner of the state, causing the worst flooding in Jacksonville's 250-year history? The Category 4 hurricane had weakened to a Category 1 by the time the eye passed about 100 miles west of Jacksonville in the early morning hours of September 11th, but we, of course, were not spared from its wrath. The storm's position and the flow of the St. Johns River and even a nor'easter out at the beach all combined to create a perfect storm of devastating flooding through so many neighborhoods throughout this city. 1 year later, many homeowners, residents, and businesses have yet to recover. Now, activists who've been working in the hardest hit neighborhoods over the last 12 months say the situation is still terrible for so many. One such person is Hope McMath, founder of Yellow House. She's been working with homeowners on Ken Knight Drive on Jacksonville's west side ever since the storm hit. And she joins us now with a 1 year update. Hope McMath, good to see you.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts and memories of Irma striking Jacksonville 1 year ago today? And are you still struggling? Were you flooded out? Did you lose property? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or weigh in on our Facebook page. And so, I cannot believe it's been a year since we all lived through Hurricane Irma, Hope. Hard to believe how fast the time goes, but nobody saw that flooding coming. It was simply unprecedented in the history of Jacksonville, and not just downtown.
That's right. That's right. I think, you know, my experience personally was one where I was very fortunate. I actually evacuated with my family. Our homes had very little damage. My business had very little damage, which had just opened 1 week before the storm. But came to learn very quickly that the images that I was seeing on television of the incredible flooding in downtown and San Marco and Riverside was just part of the story. It was just sort of the tip of the proverbial iceberg, right? And soon came to get involved in it with other people in a community that we know as Ken Knight Drive.
Okay, so describe Ken Knight Drive after the storm went through.
So as the storm went through, and I do want to stop and say that this is obviously not my lived experience. So right. I am here trying to amplify the stories and experiences of a remarkable group of residents that I have come to know over the last 12 months. And it's really their voices that we need to listen most closely to. But as we don't have them in this space with us, I'll share with you what they have shared with me. We know that on the night of the storm, the Rebo River, which really wraps itself around the Ken Knight Drive neighborhood, came over its banks in a fury. And that the drainage system there could not even come close to taking on all that water, which it doesn't do on a good day with a heavy storm. Many of the homes were flooded, some of them hip high. Residents woke in the middle of the night helping pull people out of their homes. Very much the same type of story that we saw play out all over the city of Jacksonville, except here it was also happening in a community of poverty where very few people could leave or have any means of leaving the neighborhood.
Right. So you got in there a few days after the storm, and you've been working in that neighborhood ever since, isn't that right?
I have. I actually ended up in the neighborhood because of a good friend of mine, Pastor Gundy with Mount Sinai Baptist Church in Springfield. He had picked up the phone and called a few of us who are community activists and said, hey, I've just heard about a neighborhood where it looks like nobody has been there yet to see what has happened. And we've gotten basically calls of distress from there. So a group of people from the Progressive Coalition and from Pastor Gundy's a church group descended on the neighborhood primarily to register people for FEMA support. And when we got there, after spending an afternoon and being in people's living rooms with them, we recognized that signing people up for FEMA was like just one of many, many things that needed to be taken care of. There mm-hmm. was still no electricity. There was a pretty serious food insecurity. There was very unsafe conditions for people to be living in. And so that's sort of how we got there and why many of us have stayed there.
549-2937, what are your memories of Hurricane Irma buzzing through Florida 1 year today? Neighborhoods saw historic flooding in this community, and many homeowners' businesses have yet to recover. We want to hear your stories. Give us a call. Okay, so months have gone by, and just a week or two ago, you posted on Facebook about what was going on along Ken Knight Drive. Tell us about that.
So there has been an incredible amount of work happening throughout this period of time. Groups of volunteers from all over the country in there helping with rebuilding, teams and individuals from this community stepping up to help rebuild homes. We've got organizations like Builders Care there and the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship and many others. It's still a small group that has mobilized around Ken Knight Drive, but they're mighty and they're really committed. Last week, we were there literally putting the finishing touches on a home that we are almost finished with rebuilding, which is super exciting. This is a family, a mother with two children who have been displaced since the storm. In fact, one of her children was born since the moment she had to leave the neighborhood until now. And they are finally ready to move back in their homes. Mm-hmm. And we were there putting together furniture, and the city had sent teams of people to do a major cleanup. And it was the same day that the mayor was going to be walking through the neighborhood that afternoon on a media tour and a listening tour of residents. Residents were concerned that they were being used for that purpose.
And used as props?
Used as props. And that mostly came from, some of that, of course, we're making assumptions, but some of it came from the fact that 11 and a half months later, they had never seen those city crews in the neighborhood before then. And they certainly had not been invited to have a conversation with the mayor. And so we did go live to show what was happening in the neighborhood. Again, people were thrilled that all of a sudden, you know, some of those properties were being mowed and that people were paying attention. But there was a lot of frustration that it took that long for it to happen.
And going beyond just that one community, it's my sense that there's frustration in many communities just given how bad the storm was, how slow FEMA funds have mm-hmm. been to arrive. I believe Jacksonville Beach just announced the other day they're finally getting some FEMA funding. And what's so frustrating is that Jacksonville was really unprepared for the massive amount of storm surge and flooding that we experienced after Irma. An investigation by the Tampa Bay Times after the storm found that over many mayoral administrations, many years, civic leaders in the city let plans to fix the region's vulnerability to flooding stall out, even though public works people and flooding experts kept issuing alarming report after alarming report about the extent of the risk. It's also estimated we would need to invest hundreds of millions of dollars in Jacksonville to fix these decades-old issues with drainage, particularly in poor neighborhoods, particularly in African-American neighborhoods. Although the storm didn't spare anyone, we saw flooding in lots of different kinds of neighborhoods. So a year later, I think it's fair to say that we are not ready for another storm like this. We don't have the financial or the political wherewithal to do what all the experts say we need to do to be better prepared.
Well, I think most people would agree with that. I think there's obviously been progress. There is a long-term recovery organization group that is now in place here in Jacksonville, which wasn't in place when Irma came through. And that kind of mobilization of nonprofits and resources and government is essential in being able to respond to a storm. But of course, they're not necessarily tasked with doing that major investment of infrastructure and social services that we need to have strong, resilient communities. And when you add in some of the information we have from people like the St. John's Riverkeeper through their studies around the river itself and intrusion from the ocean, we know Northeast Florida is still at risk.
Not only that, the Weather Channel just issued a list of the five cities it sees as most vulnerable to future hurricane damage. Guess which city's on the list?
Oh, I'm sure Jacksonville is.
Jacksonville's on the list, along with Miami, Charleston, New York, and I believe Newport News, Virginia. So five eastern seaboard cities sitting there on the water, although, of course, our city center is miles inland. But, you know, we really do have a vulnerability that I think is such an issue going forward, because as we watch Florence churn toward shore, there are several storms coming right behind her. It's that time of year, and we're all sort of knocking on wood, hoping we get spared this year. And so let's go to some calls now. It's been a year since Hurricane Irma barreled through Florida. Can you believe it? 1 year ago today, where were you when Hurricane Irma hit? Did you experience flooding, storm damage? How are you doing out there now? I remember so vividly in the aftermath of the storm, Hope, being on the air around the clock for a couple of days, taking calls from so many people out there who needed information, needed water. Yes. They needed someone to come out with a boat and get them. It was just an unbelievable situation. So it's hurricane season. What are your thoughts about this year? 549-2937. Wells is in Atlantic Beach. Hey, Wells, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Hope.
Good morning.
Don't mind my voice. I'm struggling with a sore throat here. I just wanted to say that, you know, in Jacksonville, it appears that the north side, the black community, is a forgotten community. I had been up to Ken Knight and worked with Hope a little bit, helping out there. And I just want to say that I think that it was a real mistake for the mayor to talk about doing a walkthrough, since the city did nothing to help the people at Ken Knight Drive. And I just want to say, I think he owes an apology to that community.
Okay, and thanks for that. Now, for the mayor's part, and obviously we'd love to have Mayor Curry on this program. You've probably even heard him on the air talking about how we are the emergency response station for all of Northeast Florida, and we appreciate him doing those PSAs on our airwaves.
Yes.
Very much. Okay, so from the city's perspective, they can only do so much, you know, and they're working as much as they can. I'm sure that's what they would say if they were here today.
Sure, I agree. And I think it should be balanced. I do think it was an incredible misstep. I think it was just mostly being insensitive. If you really want to hear what the residents have to say, you shouldn't have to do that with media tagging along necessarily. Do the media after the fact. But the city has also played a huge role in pulling down a grant from the United Arab Emirates that's going to have an impact not just in the Ken Knight Drive neighborhood, but in other neighborhoods to help with rebuilding. And so without the city, that wouldn't have happened. Yet you have to ask yourself the question, why do we have to rely on another nation to take care of our own neighborhoods?
A grant literally from the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, is
and
coming.
And yet we don't want to turn that away.
To Jacksonville. Yeah. And tell me again how much that's going to be.
It's several million dollars. I think there's about $3 million that is going specifically to Ken Knight Drive, a bit of it going to infrastructure, some of it going to rebuilding homes. what it doesn't contain in it, at least for the Kenite Drive neighborhood, is anything for the social supports that are so needed. We can continue to talk about just rebuilding buildings, but that doesn't make us more resilient necessarily for the next storm. And it doesn't take care of the human side of the crisis of Hurricane Irma. There are people who experience trauma, loss of work, loss of place. You've got families that have been split up. So when you start to talk about the impact of a storm on a neighborhood that has been systemically neglected, it is very different than when we talk about the impact of a storm in places like where I am fortunate enough to live.
Right. You know, people that lived along certain tributaries really just had a terrible experience. The Trout River, the St. Mary's River, Black Creek in Clay County.
And in Kenite Drive, the Rebolt River.
Kenite Drive, the Rebolt River. Mm-hmm. People that live along the water, of course, in San Marco and Riverside had a terrible time and are still recovering.
Yes.
And so lots of calls on this. If you're just tuning in, we are talking about the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Irma striking this area. What are your thoughts and memories and questions about recovery 1 year later? 549-2937. Sharon is in Jacksonville. Hey, Sharon, good morning.
Hey, good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I suffered through Hurricane Matthew, and then Hurricane Matthew knocked on my back door, and my homeowner's insurance was canceled not even a year before this happens, and so I was devastated with over $70,000 worth of damage to my house with Hurricane Matthew. Hurricane Irma came through and devastated me more. FEMA, they stepped up. I mean, it was kind of like a Band-Aid on the dam. They gave me like $1,200. And I feel like I've spent my old lady money on this hurricane and now have this other hurricane coming. And now I have family wanting to come from different parts of the state to move in with me, to come to refuge with me. And I'm trying to overcome last year's damages, and this is a catastrophe.
Right. And Sharon, I'm so sorry you're going through that. And I know so many people are in your same situation. And, you know, there is a local recovery coalition, by the way. Let's mention it quickly. It's the Long-Term Recovery Organization. On Twitter, it's at Duval Recovery. You can also go to this website, Sharon, DuvalDisasterRecovery.org. If you need assistance, this is a coalition of people and organizations that are working in the communities to help people like you, Sharon. So you can even call 211 to get connected to them. So yeah, thanks for the call, Sharon.
I was going to say United Way's 211 is still active for people who need help.
Right. And so, you know, it's not as though lots of good folks aren't out there trying to help. It's just that there's so much still to do.
There's a lot to still do. And that group is doing the hard work that needs to be done. But, you know, we're still recovering from last year's storm. And if you look at Hurricane Sandy in the Northeast, that took their LTRO 6 years to fully recover from that storm.
Stanley in Jacksonville. Hi, Stanley. Good morning.
Good morning. How you doing?
Okay, thanks.
I live in the area, and I have family members that live in the area. My concern is I'm always in City Hall, but I never hear anyone talking about, even though there's a lot of organization doing things, but I'm talking about, I never heard a meeting taking place with the city and the community. I'm talking about the city of Jacksonville having a monthly meeting or a weekly meeting concerning hurricane where we could bring all our resources together. Can someone help me with that information where we are having a collective group meet on a regular basis? Because we don't have these problems for a long time in Jacksonville. And I've been here 64 years.
Right. Yeah, absolutely, Stanley. I think that's why we're having the discussion today, because this is, I mean, yeah, Mother Nature is going to do what she's going to do, but can we as a city be doing better, I think is the question. And, you know, the long-term recovery group is doing what it can. That's a private group. There's some faith-based groups part of it. So that is something that has formed. But what are your thoughts about what he's had to say?
I think his thoughts are right on. And I think that long-term recovery group, they do meet a couple times a month and to pool resources and to talk about not only how to recover from the past storm, but be more ready for what comes next. So there are some people meeting on a regular basis and doing that important work. And the city of Jacksonville is at that table with nonprofits, faith-based organizations, builders, investors, the United Way. So they, I think, are just now getting fully mobilized to be able to have that kind of impact. But I do think the point made by the caller, which is important, is even just this concept of town hall discussions and neighborhood-based discussions. We saw the St. John's Riverkeeper do that, and it was really valuable to help them know how to both provide information, but also breathe in that information from the people who actually live along these waterways so that they can direct their work and resources. It does feel like there has been a lack of being able to spotlight the specific needs of specific communities so that we are bubbling that information up to be able to learn from it as we move forward.
Lots of tweets as we mark the 12-month anniversary of Hurricane Irma. Can you believe it? May tweets us, "My son and I volunteered in a Red Cross shelter 4 days before we left to deliver him to staging for the Peace Corps in Rwanda. So grateful for that experience. I was impressed by how well elderly people in the shelter handled the situation so gracefully." Josh tweets the show, "What Hope is describing is the concept known as disaster injustice, the disproportionate impact that natural and man-made disasters have on vulnerable communities, people of color, the poor, elderly, and disabled." And we certainly saw that in Jacksonville.
We certainly did. And Kenknight Drive is a good example of that. You have elders who have lived there for 50 years. You've got young families. You've got quite a few people who are veterans who are also coming back from incarceration. And so it is a neighborhood that is African-American, where poverty has been there and a long-term neglected community. So yes, its impacts are greater and it will take longer to recover.
More tweets, "Irma's impact and our high level of vulnerability make the city's decision not to appoint a chief resiliency officer a spectacular failure." Okay, what about that? Jacksonville actually turned down money from the Rockefeller Foundation to create a resiliency officer, someone who could help the city harden up to better withstand these types of natural disasters, and not just storms, extreme heat, other stresses on cities that are expected with the march of climate change.
Agreed. And I know that that conversation around a resiliency officer has also been central to some of the hopes and aspirations of groups like the St. John's Riverkeeper. We see communities who even deal with man-made disasters like mass shootings lean into that concept of resiliency for communities to learn quickly, to move through those things and to be stronger on the other side. So it certainly does seem like the kind of thing, though I know very few details about why that was turned down, that Jacksonville could benefit from.
And as I recall, there were a number of reasons why it wasn't as cut and dried as it might look.
Never is.
But still an issue in the eyes of some. Another tweet for you, Hope. "Jacksonville is taking money from the UAE. What kind of oversight will there be? Is this a grant or a loan?"
So it is a grant. So the UAE actually, it's not just coming to Jacksonville. The UAE is investing in multiple communities around the state of Florida. After the storm, they step forward to try to help with recovery. So there's a piece of that coming to Jacksonville. I think it's overall about $10 million. There are people who can answer that question better than I can. It is a grant, and it is still going through its approval processes, and it is a grant where that money is needed. So we are certainly not sitting here saying that those funds are not, one, needed, and two, won't be put to really good use. The use has already been defined. Who defined that use? I'm not exactly sure, but it is for, again, renovation and rebuilding of part of the neighborhood of Kenknight Drive, but there's also other aspects. There's some investment that's going to be happening at Raines High School. There's some infrastructure investments, and we are grateful for it. It is troubling, though, that we have to lean on external sources. And we saw that even with volunteers coming in to help with rebuilding on Kenknight Drive. The large majority of people stepping up to help were from outside this community. And that's in part because when a whole community is going through crisis and trauma, you've got to be able to pull resources from wherever you can get them. So we certainly never want to turn those resources away, but would like, again, I think it's the resiliency question being raised.
Yes. And as we continue to move through the season, if you still need help, go to DuvalDisasterRecovery.org or call 211 for connecting to the United Way, and they can help you with whatever you hopefully still need. And Hope McMath, always good to see you. Thanks for all the good work you do in the community.
Thank you. I'm embedded amongst many others doing
this
work.
That's right. And much more still ahead. Later, Culpepper checks in with the Jaguars as they beat the Giants, then head home. But up next, a look ahead to this weekend's First Coast Heart Walk and how you can be part of it. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Mullaney, director of the Public Policy Institute at Jacksonville University. Join me for a special edition of Policy Matters here on WJCT this coming Tuesday. We'll discuss the 50th anniversary of Jacksonville's consolidation and take a look back and also ahead to our future under this unique form of government. And we'll take your calls live. Policy Matters is Tuesday afternoon at 1 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Hi, I'm Mayor Lenny Curry. It's hurricane season. Prepare now by learning your evacuation zone, updating your disaster kit to include water, non-perishable food items, a flashlight with extra batteries, a radio, and other important items. Pick up a 2018 Hurricane Preparedness Guide at your public library and visit jacksready.com for more information. Tune your radio to 89.9, the designated emergency broadcaster for Northeast Florida.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, if you're looking for an innovative and easy way to give back, just download a new free app developed by local entrepreneurs. It's called Resupply, and it's been developed by some local West Point grads. Now, Resupply gives you options for where to donate all your used household goods. It simplifies the whole process by doing everything through your smartphone. I spoke about Resupply with founder Paul Tosse.
Paul Tosse, good to talk to you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And of course, we always know there's an app for everything, but you've come up with an app that really serves an amazing purpose that is so helpful to so many people. Tell us about it. How did you come up with the idea for Resupply?
Absolutely. So Resupply's mission is to make charitable giving simple. And so we're a technology company doing whatever we can to solve problems for our 501c3 nonprofits. And so it basically started out as I was getting out of the military, I saw during PCS season. So that means your permanent change of station. You've got 2 weeks to essentially pack up your life and get to the next base. And a lot of times there were amazing household goods, furniture, sofas, dining room sets that just couldn't fit in that moving truck. And they were left at the end of the driveway. And we said, you know, there's got to be a better way to save these things from the landfill and to get these items to somebody who could use them. And so as I finished up my career in the military, I decided to pilot this idea and try it out, and went to Atlanta on Veterans Day weekend and tested out the beta test platform. And it was a great success there. And now we've officially launched general availability here in Jacksonville in June. And we'll be in Orlando, Miami, and Tampa over the next 60 days.
And what this app does is, I mean, the current model for donations, and I've done this too many times, is you fill your vehicle up with stuff you don't want anymore. You drive it to Goodwill, Salvation Army, or whomever, and you drop it off. You are changing that habit. How does resupply change that model?
Great question. So, you know, in the past, you'd have to first find a location, load up your car, as you said, and drive there. Or if you knew about a pickup service that existed, it's very hard to schedule that process or to have the truck come out. And so now, through this app, you are immediately prompted with a list of charities. You can select from based on a criteria of mission or availability and what schedule makes sense for them and for you. And then all you have to do is take pictures of your items, and then pick a time and date. And then a truck with two men will come to your house, haul away your items for free, and you actually get a digital tax receipt when the process is done. So we've made it super simple in 60 seconds, and we're really excited about it.
Now, you're a West Point grad. How did you bring the values of the military into civilian life with the creation of this app? I'm guessing you were pretty disciplined about how you went about this.
Yeah, West Point was very structured, and it was an unbelievable experience. But it really taught, you know, really everyone at the academy to solve problems. So it was, you know, your mission is to find a way to add value to the United States Army and to solve problems for your unit or your platoon. And so this mindset of, you know, any obstacle is surmountable or any, you know, adversity you can face, we can overcome, kind of transformed it into the technology space. And that mindset of, you know, let's solve a problem really works great for this app because there were so many to choose from and we had to tackle them one at a time. And we still have a long way to go, but that's exactly what we're doing right now, solving problems.
And this is happening now in North Florida. You can use the Resupply app and donate to lots of local charities, but you want this to be national, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So our vision is to be across the entire United States and to revolutionize charitable giving and to make it so that everyone defaults to the app first. Because the great news is if your first charity selection can't pick up that item for some reason, it goes into a hub and a network of all of the other nonprofits that are local, and another charity can benefit from that pickup. And so at the end of the day, now we've done all the work to network in your pickup, and it's going to get removed if the first charity can't accept it.
And all people need to do is download the app to get started. Free app.
It's a free app. If you just search Resupply Giving Made Simple on the App Store or the Google Play Store, or you can visit our website at www.resupplyme.com. You can find, you know, a link to the app right there.
Paul Tossi, of Resupply. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And to learn more, you can download that app or go to resupplyme.com. Well, the First Coast Heart Walk is coming up this Saturday in downtown Metropolitan Park. The big event marks the American Heart Association's 25th anniversary of the National Heart Walk. They've been driving forward innovative breakthroughs in treating heart disease for a quarter of a century now. With a look at that and how you can be part of the big event, we welcome Dr. Leslie Cooper, chair of the Department of Cardiovascular Medicine at Jacksonville's own Mayo Clinic. Doctor, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. Also with us, Mark Nigber. He's vice president of marketing with Advanced Disposal. Good to see you.
Good morning.
And in a moment, we'll hear about your role in all of this. But first, Dr. Cooper, it is the number one killer in this country, heart disease. Each day, more than 2,000 Americans die from heart disease. So that's the bad news. The good news is that over the last 25 years, mortality rates from heart disease and stroke have been going in the right direction. They've been going down. And what do we attribute that to?
Well, primarily, the effectiveness of groups like the American Heart Association to get the word out that we need to be living healthier. That means more exercise, better diet, paying attention to our weight, and no tobacco use.
Right. And slowly but surely, more Americans have been taking that advice, although not enough of us, right? It's still a struggle.
It is. It is a struggle. But if you can get in that 150 minutes a week, which is 30 minutes, 5 days a week, of moderate exercise, that's a huge, huge step.
And the Heart Walk, of course, is a big part of that. 25 years now of the Heart Walk happening in this country, our local Heart Walk happening this Saturday. And so people can register right up to the last minute and come downtown Saturday to Metropolitan Park. And if you register, the money you donate will go toward groundbreaking science to cure heart disease and stroke. So you're getting some exercise and you're helping others, which is great. And in addition to all of that, this is an interesting tie-in. This is the year that Advanced Disposal is working through Heart Walk. Tell us about this campaign, Mark. It's called Trash Your Bad Habits.
Yes. So what,
we all need to do that.
Absolutely. So what we did was we placed these mini garbage containers at businesses throughout Jacksonville, and we asked individuals to write down what their bad habits were, put those in the trash container as far as trashing their bad habits. And we went about a week and a half ago, we went to go make a collection, picked up the trash, and we got the results as far as all of the bad habits.
What do people write in these little collector receptacles that you've been picking up?
Yeah, so the results are in, and as expected, not exercising enough was the leading bad habit that people wanted to break. So perfect to come out to the Heart Walk on Saturday and get your exercise in. Second was, believe it or not, Jacksonville has a bit of a sweet tooth. So,
really?
Yes. So eating sweets and sugar was sort of second up there, followed by snacks. So you got to stop that snacking. So it goes what doctor said as far as eating healthier seemed to be one high on the list.
High on everyone's list. And it's cool that you're doing this because if you write something down, and then you put it in a little trash can like the one you've created, psychologically, that kind of gives people a nudge, doesn't it?
It forces you to sort of say, all right, I'm gonna get rid of that bad habit. And it was also interesting is there was also some that were not related to heart disease, but if people want to take up bad habits,
there
was
a few things. They're using you as therapy.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So there was a lot of mental health
things. Who knew Advanced Disposal would become the city's therapist in addition to picking up trash? Okay, that's funny. Okay, well, so Dr. Cooper, we all know what our bad habits are. We all know what we're supposed to do. In a wealthy country like America, a developed country, where so many Americans are overweight, it's really maddening because on the one hand, we have a lot of obesity and bad habits. We also have hand in hand with that food insecurity, people that don't have enough to eat, but they're still at risk for heart disease and stroke. This is such a serious public health issue in America. Why do you think it's so hard for us to just get serious about a healthier lifestyle? Because heart disease is preventable for most people.
Yeah. I think it begins with knowledge. And so empowering people with knowledge of their numbers, their blood pressure, and their cholesterol. So it's not expensive. You can go to a Walgreens or a neighborhood a pharmacy and get your blood pressure checked. If it's higher than about 120 over 80, you want to consider that as borderline or early hypertension. And if it's higher still, consider seeing a physician or a practitioner to help you. In terms of the tobacco use, that's again a very, very hard practice to break, a hard habit. But it's terribly important. One of the biggest treatable and reversible causes of heart disease and stroke.
Mm-hmm. And so for 80% of us, simple lifestyle changes can do the trick. What about people that have a genetic predisposition toward high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and all of that?
Yeah, so there is a significant but small population in Jacksonville and throughout the country who have inherited very high cholesterol levels. There are specific medicines that can be given to lower those cholesterol values and to prevent significant heart attacks and stroke. And the way to figure that out is by getting your cholesterol checked at least once in your early adult life.
Right, get it checked. And let me ask you as well, if people come out and do the Heart Walk this Saturday, where will their money go specifically when they register to attend? How is the money being used?
The American Heart Association uses money both to support their operations and to promote research and education, public education, and better education amongst physicians and practitioners of how to treat risk factors and how to treat more advanced heart disease. So significantly, research is key. We don't know everything that we need to know about prevention and the best way to get the message across, the most effective strategies. And so people should feel confident that the money given will go to a good cause and be effectively used.
And specifically at Mayo Clinic, what types of new treatments or what types of advances have you seen in your health system?
Oh, we have three broad areas of research in heart disease. We study populations, and we have large databases that are, some of which, like in Olmsted County in Minnesota, and some are much larger, where we describe trends. For example, as you mentioned, we know that the number of heart attacks is dropping as a percent of the population because of that kind of research. The second, which is particularly relevant to our listeners, is going to be clinical research, where we have new medicines and new devices in some cases that minimize the risk of bad events like heart failure and death. Mm-hmm. And those are actively under investigation at Mayo. And finally, we have our PhD scientists in the laboratory that are studying the mechanisms of disease. And they also work right at the interface with our clinicians to bring the latest discoveries into clinical use.
All right. With all of that said, people need to register or come out Saturday to the Heart Walk. And before they do that, Mark, can they trash some more bad habits with you in advanced disposal? Are these bins up still around town?
The bins are still in businesses. We will probably update the results as far as what we see, but they're still out there. But I think coming out Saturday and exercising is a great start.
And you're going to recycle all that paper, right?
Absolutely.
I'm just teasing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Are you guys both going to be walking in the Heart Walk?
Yes, I am. I'm going to be actually walking for my brother. He is a survivor of he was a Ironman.
Wow.
He competed in 9 different Ironmans and noticed something as far as and didn't ignore the warning signs and ended up having double bypass as a result.
My goodness.
But he did not ignore the warning signs, which is very typical of marathon runners and endurance athletes.
What were his warning signs?
To overcome. He had a pain in the back of his neck and his throat, and he just said that it just wasn't right when he was training. And so he ended up going and having a stress test and it ended up finding out that he had a serious problem. And the doctor said, guys like you, these endurance athletes, typically ignore those things and the signs. And he ended up not ignoring it. And he is recovering from a double bypass.
Wow. Well, it's a good thing he did. So how can people be part of the Heart Walk this Saturday?
Come out and walk.
You don't have to register in advance. You can register on site.
You can. Yeah.
This Saturday, September 15th at Metropolitan Park, which is right next to WJCT Studios. What time does it all get started?
Activities start at 8 o'clock, and so a lot of great fun things for the entire family. There's great information that they can achieve, screenings, kids, and also bring your dog, because there's the Top Dog Award that is
fun.
Given.
Oh, so, fun. Yeah, get your dog into it.
Yep, and then the walk starts at 9:30.
My dog could use a long walk. he's as lazy as they come. Okay, Dr. Leslie Cooper, Chair of the Department of Cardiovascular Medicine at Mayo Clinic. Mark Nigber is VP of Marketing with Advanced Disposal. Thanks, guys, for being here, and have a great walk Saturday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And in a moment, Culpepper as the Jaguars win on the road.
Clay Today reaches the heart of Clay County. Clay Today print and digital products promotes businesses while providing local news and current happenings in Clay County. Information at claytodayonline.com. Mayo Clinic, committed to delivering the world-class care only Florida's top hospital can provide. Learn more at mayoclinic.org/Florida.
The exhibit Beaches, Creatures, and Cowboys, Florida Movie Posters is opening at the Brevard Museum of History and Natural Science in Cocoa. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss the exhibit and Florida films. We'll join the search for the Maroon Settlement of Angola and talk about the Seminole and Miccosukee constitutions. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Out of jail, but under watch.
Along with the rise of mass incarceration, there's been a rise in something else, which is mass monitoring or mass supervision.
Electronic monitoring devices track a person's movements after they've been convicted or even just accused of a crime. Why the use of these devices is on the rise. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Who is in charge?
The idea that there is a power behind the throne is a powerful concept. It's not merely the realm of conspiracy theorists.
Donald Trump and his supporters talk about the deep state undermining his presidency from within. Who's pulling the strings and how much of it is real? That's next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, the Jaguars begin their Super Bowl question with a win on the road, setting up a massive showdown Sunday here at home.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
All right, Cole Peppers here. 2015 over the Giants yesterday. Fun to watch?
Not exactly the style points I think a lot of people were hoping for in the opener. Let me give you a couple of different sides of this from a couple of different perspectives. Number one, anytime you go on the road and win in the National Football League, it's a positive. Number two, when you open on the road and you don't have a lot of film on a lot of these guys, you go and you win, that's a positive. Anytime you win, period, in the NFL, you only have 16 chances to get it done in the regular season. Every time you win, it's a positive. When you get a defensive touchdown, that's a positive. The Jaguars did that with Miles Jack interception off a tip ball, ball tip by Avery Jones. However, they're going to have to be better than this offensively against the Patriots in the next game in order to get it done. And there are some questions about how healthy the Jaguars will be. Leonard Fournette went out with a hamstring injury in the second quarter, did not return. We expect to hear more about Fournette coming up. Thought the offensive line had some struggles. Andrew Norwell, the big dollar free agent acquisition who became the highest paid guard in the National Football League this offseason, didn't allow a sack last year. He allows a sack in his first game with the Jaguars, so they're going to have to be better there. Blake Bortles was 18 of 33 for 176 yards, a touchdown, but one interception. He's got to avoid the turnovers. That is absolutely essential. He's got to be something, you know, in the one turnover every two games rather than a turnover per game for the Jaguars, because this defense is going to win a lot of football games, Melissa. They are very, very, very good. They're still trying to find those weapons on offense beyond Leonard Fournette. T.J. Yeldon did some good things yesterday. Also got a little bit of contribution here and there from guys on defense. But all in all, this was a win that took contributions from a lot of different sources and not necessarily the ones you always would expect. And that's what they talked about afterwards in the locker room.
It's huge. You know, this is a really good team. And to come on the road and win the NFL is always tough, especially week one. You know, opening day, you know, the emotions are high. You know, so this is definitely a tough place to win. But I'm really proud of my guys, man. We hung in there and got a hard-fought battle.
I give it an A+, man. I thought we did spectacular. On the road, man, first game of the season, how's the Jaguar defense doing? We're doing fine.
I thought the defense did a good job. We had a good rush. Avery Jones got his hands on the ball. He was able to tip it, and, you know, Miles scored, and obviously that was a big part in it. And, you know, but give a lot of credit. You know, they had a lot of yards out there and had a lot of opportunities to win, and at the end of the day, we made the plays that gave us a chance, and we wound up getting a win, which is always good.
All right, that is Calais Campbell, Miles Jack, and then Doug Marrone there at the end. And as Marone mentioned, getting the win is good.
Yeah.
It's better than the alternative. Now the Jaguars will turn their attention, which they already have. The guys in the locker room afterwards talking about, all right, now it's the Patriots. The rematch of the AFC Championship game.
Yeah.
Sunday, 4:25 kickoff at home.
Now these fans are going to be loaded for bear. They want to see the Jaguars just trounce the Pats. They can't wait for this.
I think this is the most anticipated regular season game the Jaguars have played since their first appearance on Monday Night Football in 1997.
Yeah.
That was against the Steelers. You may recall that was the game where Bill Cowher, you know, faked punching Chris Hudson as he returned a block punt and returned it for a touchdown. I think the anticipation here for this game is so high already. There were people after the game talking about it, fans around town, social media. Everybody's looking forward to the Patriots, who, by the way, beat the Texans yesterday to help the Jaguars a bit. If the Jaguars can beat the New England Patriots, first of three straight games at home, watch out. This could be a special season.
Yeah, let's watch for that. Let's hope they do. It'd be great. Okay, let's talk college football quickly. The Gators lost to Kentucky.
First time in 32 years. The last time the Gators lost to Kentucky before Saturday was 2 months after a new talk show debuted with a little-known host by the name of Oprah Winfrey. That's how long it had been. Now the Gators have to turn around and face Colorado State, a team that beat Arkansas over the weekend. Some questions about how Dan Mullen's team will respond. This is after they beat Charleston Southern. Not very impressive there, so we'll see how things play out in Gainesville. Meanwhile, FSU won, but it was almost as troubling as the Gators' loss. They needed two touchdowns in the final 4 minutes and 2 seconds to beat Samford. I was there in Tallahassee. They've got a long way to go. They have some real issues with that team. And Willie Taggart, the new head coach, has got to find a way to get those guys motivated. Everybody trying to do what Georgia is doing, which is just absolutely rolling. The Dogs rolled at South Carolina to open SEC play. They look like the best team in the SEC East. Alabama looks like the best team in the SEC West. It's more of the same. Those two teams who played each other for the national championship last year look like they could be on course to do it again.
All righty. And nice to see some love for the late Burt Reynolds at that FSU game. Of course, he was a Seminole.
Yeah, former player and a really big contributor to the Performing Arts Center there. And not only do they have a great video between the first and second quarter, the old bandit car was on campus.
Yeah, yeah.
And at their sod cemetery, where they take pieces of grass from road wins for the football team, they had the hat that he wore in Smokey and the Bandit sitting there with a picture and flowers to commemorate him. A lot of fond memories and connections between FSU and Burt Reynolds.
That was cool to see. And always good to see you, Cole. Thanks for being here. We'll talk to you next week after the Jaguars beat the hated New England Patriots.
I like where your head's at, Melissa.
All right. And that's our show. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. 1A is up next. Thanks for listening to 89.9. And we'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.